Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to everyone here on Speaking of Reliability. Thanks for joining us. I've been talking with my colleague Fred on the subject of failure mode and effects analysis. So we thought we'd continue the conversation on the most common FMEA mistakes and how we can avoid them.
Thanks, Carl. And offline, we talked about that there's 10 altogether, but I suspect there's many more. I think you're limiting our conversation to just 10.
Yes, indeed. As I mentioned to Fred and in our first podcast on the subject, I've probably supervised or performed a couple thousand FMEAs over many decades, either with people that work in groups that I've managed or individually working on them or working with clients from different industries. And I think I've seen every possible way they can be done wrong. So these are the 10 most common mistakes that come up. But there's lots of other mistakes that happen. It's just almost an infinite number of ways they could be done wrong. But one of my passions is to share these mistakes with companies and individual practitioners so they can avoid them and thereby have a much better result from FMEAs done more quickly without the painstakingly long period of time that sometimes happens in FMEAs.
All right. So last time we talked about not taking action, looking at interfaces looking forward to how do you improve your testing program based on the FMEAs, but then also incorporating what we already know, the field history and issues that we've seen before. So that's the first four, but I think you've got a list in front of you that has a couple more.
Yeah, one of the common ones, Fred, is I'll just generalize on it, would be not addressing all the high-risk failure modes with what I'll call effective or executable action. The FMEA is a wealth of information. Depending on the procedure that's being used, we'll know what the high severity or high impact problems are. We'll know what the high frequency problems are. And in some cases, in many cases, practitioners use a third type of risk, which I'll call detection risk, which is the failure modes and causes that can go undetected during product development or even in the field. And so we have these different types of risk, and not addressing all the high risk issues would be a common mistake.
So it's not just the high RPN number, it's say something that has no detectability at all is what something you would say is a high risk?
It could be if it's a problem of concern. Obviously, if it's a very low severity or it isn't a very low frequency, then we're not so much concerned about detectability. But if it's a problem that we're concerned about, either because of the severity of the effect of the problem or because of the frequency or both, then yes, detection becomes an issue.
Well, I think it's even in your book, is that the high severity ones, especially when it deals with injury or death or catastrophic loss, or those are addressed regardless of the frequencies. You need to consider it and how your design responds into those circumstances. But it sounds like you're adding the high frequency items also.
Yes, here's the way I look at it. As you mentioned, Fred, and this is one of the problems with RPN, risk priority number, which is the product of the severity ranking times the occurrence ranking times detection ranking. Some people try to use that as the be-all, end-all of risk prioritization, and it really isn't. It has limitations, and one of the biggest limitations is high severity, low frequency, or low RPN can be very serious. and has to, I always address high severity issues first, regardless of frequency or RPM. Make sure that the FMEA team and management is comfortable that we are facing and looking at and understanding the risk from high severity, and that we've taken every action that we need to reduce the risk. So that becomes part of addressing high risk failure modes, and then followed by, after that, we can go after the high RPNs or the high frequency problems, and then where there's also detection risk, and start reducing those. Mm-hmm. So once we've got that risk identified, then not addressing it adequately with good recommendations. I always want to see multiple recommendations when I see high risk. Try to reduce severity by itself. Right. Go into fail safe or fault tolerance, and then other types of robustness actions to reduce frequency, reduce stress strength interference, things like that.
Right. Right. It's a, what I'm thinking of is that there's issues where you get a high score for high severity or a high score for high frequency. And so those are considerations. How about the scenarios where you have like a cluster that they all might be modest RPN numbers, but they all come from a common cause or a common issue, that if you solve one thing, it benefits a dozen different things?
This is why I want the team to look at the risk, because in cases like that, you can get, it might not show up. This is why I never use RPN thresholds, because you can miss opportunities, mm-hmm. like you're describing. And so I want people to look at the risk, look at the analysis that's done in the FMEA, and start working away at it, because very often you can take actions that affect a lot of different lines on the FMEA, which is what you're alluding to.
Right.
So I'm by all means.
So I think the message here is you know, conduct the FMEA, but put some thought into addressing the high severity, the high occurrence ones, and I'm recommending the clustered ones for high benefit from doing the study.
Yeah.
But actually not just addressing in a perfunctory way each item, but actually listing out, you know, what's the investigation, what's the study, what's the reduction of variability, what are the steps you're going to take to improve the design, that kind of detail.
Beautiful. And I have a chapter in my book called Action Strategies to Reduce Risk.
I was just reading that last night.
Oh, okay. Well, very good. And because there are a lot of different strategies, and that's the point, is here we're reliability professionals. We have a rich bench of tools mm-hmm. that we can bring in. And that's what I try to teach in FMEA, is let's use that wealth of tools and that knowledge and bring that to bear against the problems and the risk.
Yeah, excellent.
So another one is, now some of these I can move through fairly quickly. One of them I call level of detail, which is having the right level of detail. And that's not easy to teach. It's like when you first learn how to ride a bike, it doesn't seem natural. Some people have put in too little detail and they're not really getting to a good statement of root causes and effective actions. And others swing the pendulum the other direction, which is too much detail. And you end up with FMEAs that are hundreds of pages long, or I've seen them in thousands of pages, mm-hmm. That where you miss the forest for the trees. And so what I try to teach is each step of the FMEA, from function, we'll want the functions described well enough so we can get failure modes. And we want failure modes described well enough so we can get to the effects and the causes. And we want the effects described well enough so we can identify the severity risk, and the causes well enough so we can identify the controls and ultimately become actionable to reduce, develop recommended actions. So each step of the FMEA, if you understand the fundamentals of the steps, then you can get the right level of detail so that you get good results in your FMEA. But you don't go on to long, trivial exercises of too much detail that doesn't address risk.
Well, what happens in the scenario where you come up with a failure mode, the machine won't start, for example, and one, it has a severity that's not injurious, it's not catastrophic, but you lose all functionality of the product. Mm-hmm. But other severities are, I mean, you could list another 20 consequences of that. Do you cut off the discussion to take just really the dominant ones early on?
Yeah, for example, you could imagine one that's really easy to see is, let's say you're doing an FME on an engine system and or on a vehicle, and you have an oil leak. That could be potentially catastrophic if you're in drive mode.
Right.
And whereas if you're parked, it might be a spot of oil on the floor.
Right. Well, that's environmental. Out here in California, that's catastrophic.
That could
too.
Be very serious. Okay. So, but the team can, the procedure itself of FME says that we're going to look at the most serious effect, and we're going to assess the severity based on the most serious effect. So the team could identify other effects if they wish, but the most serious effect is what's going to be carried forward in the FMEA as from a risk assessment standpoint.
Right.
And so you can cut off conversation if it's low risk.
Yeah, and it's a balance because the oil leak, it may occur more often, but the loss of all oil and engine block seizure is very rare. It's a balance between those two. But if you start listing every single consequence, then you've kind of gotten into the weeds.
Exactly. And so that's a skill, and that would be a mistake is getting into the weeds. And it's one that we can teach, but it takes experience and coaching to so you know what level of detail is the proper level, and that would be the quality objective.
Yeah, good.
Another objective is timing. Or another mistake would be doing FMEAs late. You can do them in theory, Fred. You could do them too early, which is, you know, you don't have a concept identified. But in practice, the mistake is often doing them late.
Well, it's one of those good to do things. It might even be required by a contract, and we have to check it off. So I think that's one of the reasons we get it late. We also get it late because there's a pushback of the design guys, the design team doesn't know what the product is yet. So there's hesitancy they want to wait until we have it ready to release to production. I think there's another mistake.
Yep, I agree. And this comes down to what is our objective. If our objective is to improve the design, to design in safety and reliability and quality, then we'll want the FME to parallel the design process. If the objective is to pass some conformance or check off and make sure that we've done the FMEA, well, then I don't want to be involved in that.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I enjoy the FMEA that has value and is done well. So the timing becomes a potential mistake. It takes management. Always when I work with companies, I want to talk with management, teach them their roles and responsibilities, which is different than doing the FMEA. It's specific, you know, support structure. And they, with their help, with management help, we can get the FMEAs done at the right time, and it leverages the value tremendously.
Yep.
So that would be the quality objective.
Good.
Another one, Fred, is the right team. And it's really common. It happens so often with the pressures in organizations to try to get the FMEA done with one person or maybe two people. And yet the value is so much enhanced. If you're good at facilitation, if you can run the meetings well, then the value with the team of people just enhances the results of the FMEA tremendously. The way I teach it is people have blind spots. Mm-hmm. And so if you just do an FMEA by yourself or one other person, you're going to bake in the blind spots, and then you're going to miss out on these opportunities for discussion that will overcome the blind spots, and actually the synergy will find things that the individual won't.
Well, that reminds me, I think it's an Einstein quote, which I may not have correct, but it was basically a subject matter expert or designer of a complex part of a system, if they can't explain it such that other engineers or your management team can understand it. They probably don't really understand it. And so having that team there, if nothing else than to be an audience and to ask clarifying questions, can really, really help to identify those blind spots.
Yeah, that's right. Definitely. That's right. So that's a big part of doing FMEs correctly, is having the right team. And that includes having people show up. So we're not just talking about the team roster.
Right.
Talking about people showing up. And that also includes, I'll take it one step further, is having people participate.
Yeah, show up and then turn your phone off or put your laptop down. Yeah.
Put the clamshell, you know, close up the clamshell and turn off your phone.
Well, that comes to part of facilitation is what are the norms, but also to make it engaging. It has to hook people and make it valuable for all participating. And that's tricky to do sometimes. Definitely,
it is. I try to teach people how to balance the involvement. This comes down to personality styles. The extroverts tend to take over the meetings, so the facilitator has to learn to slow down the extroverts and to draw out the introverts, because obviously introverts have just as much to offer.
They just
don't talk as much.
That's right.
So two more, and then we'll round off this particular discussion. One of the mistakes that is really what I call documentation, or it's have we properly filled out the FMEA or done the FMEA according to the fundamentals? So I'll look at each column and say, is that the right statement of function? Does it have the standard performance? Is the FMEA the manner in which the item doesn't accomplish the function? Is the effect the consequence on the system or the end user? Is the cause stated as a design deficiency, including a failure mechanism for root causes? And things like that. So I'll look at the FMEA and work with the team to see, are we properly describing the entries in the FMEA based on fundamentals?
Well, that sounds a lot like we should create a checklist, basically, is how do you evaluate an FMEA? That list of questions you just asked is, as you're looking across a row on your study, even while you're doing it, you could use that during the facilitation part. You can.
Like, are the design controls, what's currently planned or in place, not things that the team believes needs to be done differently, because those would show up in the recommendations column.
Right.
So just, a set of questions like that are really helpful to teams and become good thought triggers. And any mistakes along the definitional line or the fundamentals line would be that one. Mm-hmm. And the last one, the final one that I added, used to have nine mistakes. The final one I added is valuable time use. Mm-hmm. And so I'll go around to the FME team members and ask each of them, is this a valuable use of your time? Did you get a value-added result? And it takes a lot of humility to do that, Fred.
Yeah.
Be willing to accept what they say.
Yeah. But it's also the feedback into that process within your organization and your facilitation skills.
Yep.
You need to hear it in order to improve.
You absolutely need to hear it. You're totally right. But not a lot of people want to hear it. So that's why I included on this list of 10 is always take a minute and get in touch with your team and get a reality check as how you're doing and whether we're on the right track, and paying attention to people's time. If you don't pay attention to people's time and try to get the FME done in the least amount of time that you can, it's going to be hard getting people to meetings.
Well, it goes back to what we started with the last episode, which was on the perception. The taint, basically, mm-hmm. that's around FMEA in some organizations. Now, in some, where it is a viable, valuable process, and it's done when it adds value, not just carte blanche and a checklist item, people will show up. They will be prepared, and they will engage and make a difference through this tool because they know it can add value. It takes some consistency, though, and doing a good job of doing that. And so this I think we're going to have to talk some more about creating a a short checklist. How do you evaluate this? I think that would be really useful during the facilitation process, but also in evaluating your process as you go along and look at these things. But we have the notes and this item of 10 things. And so I think you and I'm biting at the bit here to go with another 10, but we should ask the audience, you know, what's your favorite or least favorite mistake or a slap on the forehead moment when you're doing an FMEA that occurred? How would you do to avoid that?
That's great. Let's do that. Open it up to the audience and send us in your thoughts as to common mistakes that you've seen.
That's right. So. That's right. Might make the next edition of your book if we get some good stuff.
It could. Absolutely. Well, it looks like we've finished up another Speaking of Reliability. So thank you very much, Fred. And please do, to the audience, please do send in your suggestions on this topic or any other topic on Speaking of Reliability.
Thanks, Carl.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.